Paul Rodel, and it is June 17. It's about 17 minutes before 8 o'clock, and I'm in the home of Carl. You use your middle initial R, Stockton, and we've just had a good dinner. Kind of, we're all full, and I think enjoying ourselves. Vietnam service, 1963 through 65. As a teacher, TESOL or TEFL, probably, English, in Longjiang province. Is that, or that's the town?
Yeah, and it was also it was the provincial city. The province was Anh
Yes,
Giang.
you have that in parentheses
Yeah,
behind, and so near to Saigon. We'll go through this a little bit later, or at least bounce off of this for other things. But one thing that was not on this form, and I'll use this as the beginning, as the launching pad. And I told you this, you may remember I mentioned this when we were still in your office, that there's nothing here about your own personal background. Even things like date of birth, who your parents were, where you grew up, what was your formative part of your youth and education that eventually led you to this kind of involvement in your life. So if you could add that, that would be an excellent starting place.
I was born October 13th, 1935, in a rural area of southwest Missouri, near a town called Monett, which was a town of about 6,000 and still is. It was a railroad center back in the days of steam. It was a roundhouse where locomotives came in and they were repaired and they could turn around. It was an important railroad center and really a railroad town. It was a one sort of industry town. My father was a railroader, but we lived in the country. I was the seventh of seven children. I was quite a way behind the sixth, so that there was quite a wide stretch. For example, during most of my life, I never knew my two eldest brothers because they were away from home. They were quite a lot older, as were at least two of my eldest sisters. I grew up on a farm, a small one, because we didn't depend upon the farm for our livelihood, as my father was in the railroad business. But he had actually come from a farm background, and he thought that it was important for character building as well as economic stability to live on a farm where everyone worked, had their own responsibilities, where there was plenty of room, and where one could survive, at least in case there were difficulties with other sources of income. So that was how I grew up. I went to a country school, one room, all 8 grades in one building. Not a terribly large building. There were probably around, oh, maybe at the very most there would have been 40 students altogether, but probably more like 30 at the most, in all grades from 1 through 8. And I went all 8 years through that one-room country school. And when I talk to people about that, they're just lost in amazement because they've never heard of such a thing, and it's beyond the experience of a lot of people. But indeed, it was a part of the experience of many people growing up in the Midwest, and certainly with me in Southwest Missouri. It was a good experience because we had several different teachers, all of whom I can remember very well. And one of the remarkable things about an elementary school and junior high school all rolled up in one room out in the country was that one learned very quickly to help with the other students. Because there was no such thing as being sort of partitioned, it was all in one room. And rather like a family, the older ones helped with the younger ones. And the older one got, the more responsibility one had for the younger students coming up. Only one teacher who had the responsibility for all of those 8 grades, so therefore that teacher did need assistance. And so it was a part of, it was a kind of a crude prefecture system that was well developed in early America and had been a part of English educational systems, but we never really called it that. It was a part of peers, older peers helping each other, and that worked with me because it gave me an early sense of responsibility. Although coming from a large family, I had no younger brothers and sisters, and this certainly made up for it
39
because
times.
I had a had an opportunity to work with them and to socialize with them. I had to walk about 1.5 miles to school every day and walk back. We had a car, but of course my father took the car to work very early in the morning, came back after we had got out of school, so there was no question of riding in the car. We walked everywhere. We took shortcuts across the fields,
And no
often in
buses.
very, no, oh heavens no, very bad weather oftentimes. So that was a good experience. I learned a lot. I read a lot, and I think I was inclined to do so. I came from a very large family. Of course, I had sisters who were older and who were at home, and who certainly helped me with reading. I read everything in our school library very soon, and graduated into the town library as I could get in. But as we were about 3 miles away from town, it wasn't an easy thing to get into town, so I had to depend upon our one-room schoolhouse and the books that were there. I went to a country church, which was a Methodist church of the Methodist Protestant variety before unification of all the Methodists in 1939. It was Methodist, of course, at the time I went. Very small, again, one room. Country church, went to Sunday school there. That was a part of my growing up, my tradition. I learned to do chores very early. I was responsible for milking cows as soon almost as I could reach up to their udders and shoveling out the barn. It was a responsibility that I had again very early on, feeding the livestock, pigs, chickens, and so forth. That was all a part of my early experience growing up. Had friends in neighboring farms. There were creeks, there were ponds in which we had some opportunities to play, went hunting with sometimes, and never did like it very much. Fished a lot, swam in the creeks, and it was really a rural existence until I was in high school, which came at a rather earlier age for me. I had started school early. I rode the bus. Usually got on around 6:30, arriving in at the school by 8, sometimes after. When I was I had completed my I at the time I was a freshman in high school, all of my brothers and sisters had gone away from home, so I was the only one remaining. My father became very ill during my freshman year. Because I couldn't take care of the farm, which wasn't huge, but it was an enormous responsibility. We had to sell up and move into town, into Monett, which was a town of, as I say, around 6,000. So from there, I continued, of course, to go to high school, and my father died fairly early on. As I say, I was late in the marriage of my mother and father. So by the time I was really a sophomore, from the time I was a sophomore, I was in a home without a father and with a widowed mother who had to go to work, had to do things as best she could. Although there was a pension, it really was not adequate. And although we owned the house, it was tough going. Even with the pension, I also began working very early, doing summer jobs and jobs after school. Had a very good high school experience, however. I did as much as I possibly could, given the responsibilities for work that I had, which were a lot. I was in briefly in sports, but that was very difficult. But I got interested in, and I think got fairly good at debate and speech competitions, and that was a good extracurricular activity for me. I was in the choir, I was in band, and managed to get a lot in to that rather small, but I think very good high school. It had been also a junior college, so that the faculty who doubled at the college and the junior college were at least equipped with master's degrees and were very experienced and very fine. The result of all this was that I got languages early on. I had a very full Latin education and Spanish, and I had the advantage of having superb history, a wonderful history professor who was a teacher who was also a taught in the junior college. He was very, very skilled. So I was awakened to history very early, awakened further to the wonderful world of learning and of books. I went to university. I got a scholarship, a full scholarship to a college in Springfield, which is about 50 miles away, called Drury College, a fine, small liberal arts college. But even though I had a full scholarship, it really was very tough to get along, having absolutely no financial assistance from home. And although I was working at Drury, it was just very difficult to survive. So after a year, I transferred to the State University, which was in the same town, which is much, much cheaper, as I was able to live off campus. And I was able to work a little more, and it was a rather larger institution too, and it provided lots of opportunities. I got a bachelor's degree from that institution
Which was which
at
one?
Southwest Missouri State
Really?
University in
Okay. All right.
Springfield,
Yeah.
which was very fine then, very small, but now much larger and one of the very good state universities, certainly in Missouri. And then after that, I had, meanwhile, I should say that in My growing up in high school, I'd become involved in church in the town, and I thought that my vocation might lie within the church in some area or another. And indeed, I kept nurturing that view, and I had several people in the church, including pastors who were very kind to me and also very encouraging, certainly in terms of my intellectual pursuits and also in terms of my interest in the church. And not having a father, I think that was, I leaned certainly toward male models that would pay any attention to me and to give some direction in my life. And so very early on in the college experience, I first thought, oh, I wanted to be a medical doctor, and then I thought, oh, I want to be a teacher, and finally I thought, yes, I really would like to be in the church, but probably not as a clergyman. That I would like to teach in a church setting. So I went off, having gotten a scholarship again, to Boston University for graduate school.
What year would this have been now?
This was in 57, graduating from high school in 57. Went to Boston from 57 to 60, a 3-year program in theology, and with an emphasis really on ecclesiastical history, as much as one could have an emphasis. It was a general sort of degree. The idea being that, and I had developed the idea that I wanted to teach in a seminary, and the idea was that if you want to teach in a seminary, you'd really have to go to one. That there was no such thing as just sort of bopping in from the outside,
They have their
so.
own network.
Exactly, and you needed to know the kind of training that these people would have from the perspective of being a student. And so I did that. Had a lot of good teachers. I took a lot of courses at Harvard, which we were able to do. I had, for example, Paul Tillich, who was there. He was lecturing on his final volume of systematic theology. It hadn't been published yet. Nearly did me in, as well as all of his other students. Very difficult to understand. Luckily, there were wonderful graduate assistants that he had who helped some of us who had difficulty in understanding what he was talking about to get through that course, which I did, and it was a memorable experience. I also had people like George Buttrick, who's the Harvard Chapel. I had Richard Niebuhr in ethics at Harvard, a wonderful person. Also, a man called Robert Pfeiffer, who was a brilliant person in the sort of intertestamental period, which awakened my great interest in Roman and Greek studies. I took Greek, I took Hebrew, and theology, philosophy that I had not had, of course, at a state institution in which I majored in English, speech, and history. I had a triple major, so it was really well. In Boston was
Triple
a,
major?
yes, Boston was a
Oh
wonderful town.
Oh.
It really was. There were so many colleges and universities there. Again, it was for a boy from Missouri, even though I was from a railroad family, which had the great advantage of getting passes, so that we could travel, even though we didn't have a lot of money, we could at least travel because we had passes all over the railroad systems of America. And I had not stayed within the confines of Southwest Missouri, but I had been there a lot and not been traveled a lot. Boston was just a wonderful, eye-opening, wonderful experience.
It still is.
And yes, oh, it's just terrific. And I just can't commend it enough, both for the people I met and the professors I had, And the things that I learned, just opening up new vistas of intellectual inquiry, it certainly confirmed my idea that I really wanted an intellectual life, that I wanted to teach. But I was still thinking that it was in the, my calling was to be in seminary. And so at the end of my experience at Boston, I went into the pastorate, which again was essential for anyone wanting to teach in seminary. I'd been very well coached that you had to, if you're going to be teaching in a seminary that's training people to be pastors,
you've got to find out what they need.
Absolutely. And that's right, too, yeah. I think. Dead right, that you can't sort of start talking about running into, to, you know, to talk about things that are so sort of abstract truths that that people just aren't interested in and want to understand. So,
you know, Carl, I wish the colleges of education would have the same requirement.
I think back on this and I think how very, very clever that all was. I think it's changed a little bit now, but I went into, I went back to Missouri. I was ordained into, this was the Methodist, and I was ordained into the Methodist church.
When would this have been?
This was in 1960.
Oh.
I graduated from seminary.
Oh, that was very quick. So that was, came automatically.
Quick, yes. Yeah. And I had thought, well, I will do this for 3 years, and then I will get advanced my advanced degree, and then go into teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did my work in church, one little place near Kansas City, near, in fact, Independence, Missouri.
Oh,
where
I've heard of
President
that.
Sherman was. And
was he in your congregation?
No, he was a Baptist. His wife was an Episcopalian, though.
All right.
And speaking of that, I must say that when I was in Boston, I really discovered the Episcopal Church and just went there every opportunity I could, especially to Trinity Church Boston on Copley Square. And I really fell under the influence of the most marvelous man whom I think more than any other person in all the world has influenced me. The most, and his name was Theodore Parker Ferris. He was the rector of Trinity Church Boston, and I liked him very much. He was also an adjunct teacher at Boston University, but was one of the best known clergymen, I think, probably in all of the United States. He was a marvelous preacher and just a marvelous man with a superb mind. And a very wonderful sort of humane sense of direction. And so when I had this church near Kansas City, it was only one church, and it was a good experience. I learned a lot. I was very energetic. I within a year's time, I had launched a fundraising campaign and had reconstructed the church, which was in bad need of work, and had an enormous building campaign, had that all done, and then I suppose that I did so well that the bishop called me to another place immediately, to a place that, in fact, had just been built, but was in need of being built up in terms of its people, its programming, and probably to expand what had just been built in a very growing section of Joplin, Missouri, which was in the southwest part, which is near Monette. And I went there, and I stayed for 2 years. During that time, I began to think very seriously about the while it was a good experience for me, I again think that I needed to know something more about the world than I did, even though I had had the advantage of going away to a school that I had had a lot of advantages. I decided that I really would. I felt the need to get out of my surroundings and see something of the world. In thinking of that, it just all sort of came together when I read an advertisement in the Christian Century, which is a very fine weekly, I think, that all of us took and we all read in those days. And there was an advertisement from the International Voluntary Services, and they were recruiting for Southeast Asia, and they were recruiting especially for Indochina, which was still called then, including Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. And I had literally just only slightly heard of these places. I didn't know very much. Typically American, even with a very good education, my geography and my knowledge of the world left a lot to be desired. But they certainly sounded exotic. I tried very hard to find out all I could about Vietnam, particularly. I had read Tom Dooley. He was, and I was fascinated by him, and I knew his parents. And this got me interested in Vietnam. And
where did you
St.
know
Louis.
In St. Louis.
He was his parents were in St. Louis. That's where he grew up. And we just had some mutual acquaintances. And I had done, and I'd read his books. And I read more of them. And when I saw this,
the night they burned the mountain.
Yes,
that's
right.
One title.
That's right. And I've forgotten.
This just came into.
They were there, and oh, terribly inspiring, you know, the needs that were, and, you know, his own life. And I thought, you know, I can perhaps meet some of these needs as well. And, you know, the situation in Vietnam, which in those days was a very, you know, obviously trouble was brewing, we knew that, but that was not a factor at all in my wanting to go there. It was the idea of being able in some way to help, to do something that would be helpful for that country. And again, very idealistic, I think, but very inspired by this example. And so I applied, and lo and behold, I was accepted. They did a good job of screening in those days. They had, you know, it was, we were a contract agency for the, what was then called USOM, which was obviously a part of the State Department. And there were anyone who was involved with them, even on a contract basis, were screened pretty carefully. I think that...
And USOM is United States...
Operations Mission.
Operations Mission? Okay.
That's right. Which became USAID.
Mm-hmm.
United States Agency for International Development.
Yeah.
Very shortly. In fact, I think during the process of time, the time I was there. And this was an agency that I was, you know, we were, as I say, was marvelously well screened. I don't know whether everyone was or whether I was just suspicious. I know that this is a delightful incident. I was in this parish. I really didn't want my parishioner to know that I was thinking of leaving. I'd just been there for 2 years again. We'd started yet another building program. It was a marvelous situation, but I didn't really want to know them, except that one evening I was sitting in the parsonage, and along came a very trusted parishioner who said to me, "You know, if you're in trouble, I want you to know that." That we're here and we can help you out. And I said, oh, I'm very pleased to know this, but am I in trouble? You know, and so this went on, and very carefully trying to explore what this was. And finally, this parishioner said, well, we had a visit from an agency of the federal government, and to ask questions about you. And come to find out, their assumption was that I was in some sort of tax trouble, because, you know, why else would the feds be down asking questions about, because they simply didn't announce what they were doing, apparently. But anyway, these parishioners were very, very sympathetic, and I just, of course, had to say that I had no idea what this was. And then it occurred to me that there was probably someone was going to ask questions about me. So the cat was out of the bag, and it finally turned out that I was accepted in the program. Before I knew it, I was off to orientation at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and I met a lot of other people, much younger people, really, a lot of younger people who were just out of undergraduate school.
I've got this
birth through education.
Well, through education, and you're now in your mid-20s, and, you know.
That's right.
I'd say that for a half hour to go through a quarter of a century of your personal life.
A lot being left out.
Yeah, there's a lot left out.
But anyway, I think this is very amusing, this whole business of being sort of vetted for this operation. Because later on, I discovered that the International Voluntary Services was just such a rather loose, informal organization. I couldn't imagine that they had taken the trouble, but I suspect that it was one of those requirements that
And it
was
probably
made.
Wasn't, it probably wasn't IBS, it was probably
the contract agency.
Yeah, probably AID said, you know, here's a list of people,
yes,
check them out.
And didn't want me to be a subversive person going in to undermine,
right,
you know, the government.
So do you think it was FBI that was asking questions?
I think it could well have been. I was just utterly amazed and couldn't figure out at the solicitude and the delicacy with which they, you know, my friends, my parishioners handled this. They were, it was just very kind. They were, they just thought that I was in deep trouble and that they needed help, and they wanted me to know that they were there and ready to help.
Well, I'm going to tell you an amusing parallel story.
All right. Okay.
So, and I'll have I'll put this on pause so we don't waste tape for my stories.
Okay.
You know, your story's fine, not mine.
Okay.
And then I'll turn it on after.
Okay.
So there are parallel stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I've turned the tape back on so that you can proceed.
Well, when I think back on it, it happened very quickly. I was amazed. I'm amazed at the resolution that I had that I was going to do this. It was
It's a life change.
Oh, a bizarre kind of switch.
And you can't locate any.
No, you know, it would be sort of like a divine calling, if I really believe that. I'm not sure that I do at all.
Or a midlife crisis, but you're far too young.
No, I'm very young. And going through the orientation and coming down, landed first. We went through via Alaska to Tokyo first time.
Mm-hmm.
In either place, stayed overnight in Tokyo, and then landed in Vientiane.
Mm-hmm. Oh, directly.
I think from Tokyo. I'm pretty sure that was the case. But anyway, quite unusual, quite unlike anything I'd ever seen. Just looking out the plane windows, it was it was a hoe. I realized at once that I was in just a whole new world, and one that no orientation in the world could ever quite prepare one for.
How long it was the language, orientation?
Not long enough. It was probably a month in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about this, Paul. You'd have to check, but it wasn't very long. The idea was that you'd get most of your orientation on site, which of course is an interesting idea, and it is true that much of the orientation did come on site. I think there could have been a lot of other things done, in America, and particularly as far as language goes. I had to battle hard, even though I'm not bad in language. It was not an easy one.
Yeah,
and we were shipped off very soon to a provincial town called Nitaw in Vietnam, where we all gathered together to learn Vietnamese. And the idea was that we would go out, we'd be in this provincial town where no one else spoke English, and we would be totally immersed in a Vietnamese uh-huh. culture. And we would be, we would have to use our Vietnamese.
You and say we, how many were you?
Oh, there were probably around maybe less than 20. Mm-hmm. Probably less than that, maybe 16 at the most. We all lived in one rather large house. We were in, perhaps the men and the women were separated in different houses, but in this provincial.
And no married couples?
Yes,
we had
a couple of married couples. And don't ask me how that was arranged. I know that the orientation was, again, mostly language. And really, it was getting used to food. I know I lost about 30 pounds within,
so
within about a month's time, and that was very good. But I know, sending pictures back home, my mother just couldn't quite believe it. She was very alarmed that I had lost so much weight. With the diet of...
Yeah.
Primarily rice and fish, and learning to eat expertly with chopsticks was, it's all a different kind of thing. The smells were different. The whole idea of the care with which one had to deal, for example, with water. You sort of couldn't turn the tap on and even brush your teeth. We were told to be very, very careful about that, and we were, I think some of us were more careful than others, and in spite of the care, many of us got ill. I was lucky. I didn't, except when I was there for a year and had the wonderful opportunity to go outside Vietnam for R&R, and I went with other friends to Bangkok, and from there caught a third-class rail to down the peninsula, Malay Peninsula, to Singapore. It was a wonderful experience, except that during that time on holiday, I got dengue fever, which was very debilitating.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, I came down with this on Penang, which was a very exotic place to come down with anything. And I had gotten to know mutual friends, friends of people whom I'd known in the States who were on Penang and who took very good care of me. I had to stay there and went on then after about a week down to Singapore. And when we were there, thinking this was such a relief that there was, security, you didn't have to worry very much about it. But when we were, got to, when I got to Singapore, having been delayed a week more than I thought that I would be in Malaya, I found that my friends had gone and that I had landed in Singapore during a riots between the Islamic people and the Chinese. There were it was Muhammad's birthday, I think, some holiday, and there were real riots and there was martial law declared. This after having the experience of martial law. Recall I was there in 63 when in I think it was November of that year Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated, and there were coups sort of one after the other. It was after all that, and I had landed in yet another difficulty, so I really didn't get to enjoy Singapore very much.
Well, what? When did you actually arrive in South Vietnam?
This was in the summer of 63.
So it was in the summertime. Mm-hmm. So you were there for a few months of Diem's assassination,
right.
And so you and saw.
I was in my school in the province when this happened, and it was an amazing experience because. Great feeling of instability. I was one of the very few Americans. I was certainly the only American civilian in Long Xuyen. There was a MAG or a military advisory unit there because it was a provincial capital. And it was the center of an effort to develop communities and community defense in the province, and there were special forces not far out within the province as well. So there were those Americans, of course.
These are American special forces?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that early?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were. And they were marvelous people. Of all of the military people I met, I had the most admiration for them because they lived very simply. They lived the life of the the lowliest Vietnamese peasant, farmer. They lived off the land. They learned the language, which was highly unusual for American military.
Oh yeah,
And they were dedicated and very very committed and very capable of living within their environment. So I admired them very much, and I did meet them, and in fact had gone. I went out to their camps, but one of the interesting things I think when I went to the province. We were all assigned rather mysteriously. We didn't have much to do with it, and I think it was the result of the orientation and what people thought where one could be best placed. I suppose.
That's very likely.
You know.
I think Peace Corps did that too.
But I went to Long Xuyen, which was the province of Van Tran, provincial capital. It wasn't too far from Cambodia. It was down south, a very delta-like town. It was also the center of a group of people who were very, very pro-American. Who were a different, and I'm groping because I can't remember their names. It was a tribal. Group of people, the Hwahao. That's right.
Yeah.
And
you wrote about that just one sentence in your yellow sheet.
They
I said,
were,
I've got to talk to this guy because I really want to know
well,
somebody
they were
who's
a wonderful group because, of course, as people know who study sociology and history of people, they were a group who didn't fit into the majority culture.
Not at all.
But they were very different. They had different ideas. And the result was that they were quite prepared to attach themselves to other people, even foreign people who were totally outside the majority. And so therefore, very fiercely pro-American and very fiercely anti-communist, anti-Viet Cong. This was a great center for them in the Anshan province. One of the interesting things about being there, I had at first gone to, I said I was in on the American. There was a point of contact because a guy from with USOM in community development, with his wife, if you can believe this, and children were there in this province. They were but he was a former IBSer who was in Vietnam, had learned the language, and was just a, his name is Paul Worthington, just one of these sort of model volunteers.
Paul Worthington.
Paul Worthington, who later, who was in USOM at the time I was there. He was a wonderful guide for me. He had been through everything, and he was very, in a very good way, had warned me about a lot of things, helped me with language. Paul later died in Thailand when he was still with USOM. But his widow, Linda, is still very active, although she herself wasn't with IBS. She's in Washington, and she was on the IBS staff and is still very active with IBS alumni.
I'm going to make a note of that and hopefully
Paul
try to look her
up.
Paul
was a marvelous man. I can't tell you how good he was. Very low-key, as I say, a model volunteer who knew his language, who understood his mission very well, knew how to talk with people, and was a totally dedicated person, and was so dedicated that that he thought nothing of having his family there. You know, essentially very trusting, even in a hostile situation, was a superb person, taught me a lot. I lived with him, his wife, his family, and ultimately, though, he was transferred out. I kept his cook and general factotum, who did everything in this rather too large house for one person. Remember, it was for his whole family, but I kept it because it was on contract with USOM and it was easy to do.
How did he die?
In Thailand, he died in an accident. I think it was a boating accident. I'm not sure about that, but I know it was a great shock. And this was much later on. He had been transferred again with USAID into Thailand. When I was in Long Xuyen, and again, I had inherited this house, I took in a Vietnamese teacher, a physics teacher, to live, to rent a place there, and that helped a lot. And he was very helpful to me as a Vietnamese and as a colleague who helped me a lot. I had a little Lambretta scooter with which I got around, this was what many of the faculty had in the lycée where I taught. I had a pretty full load. I got to know the principal very well, his English was rather good. One of the things that I found, and this will be true, I'm sure, of other people to whom you talk, was that particularly in education, but also among provincial government officials, there was a real pride in knowing French, because this was the mark of an educated individual. If they were educated, they would have gone to French school. And therefore, knowing French was, a sure sign of a civilized, cultured, educated person. So upon seeing me and others like me, there was the immediate sort of assumption that we too knew French. And so, despite the fact that my Vietnamese was relatively good, people with whom I worked, certainly at the principal level, but also teachers, immediately burst out in French, demonstrating their own cultural abilities.
And maybe practicing.
And practicing. And I was having to rely upon my high school, actually my college French. I started French in college, and I had about 3 years, but good grief, it wasn't nearly at the level of my Vietnamese, which I had been working very, very hard on. And of course, I tried to start out in sort of halting Vietnamese. They immediately stopped and ran into French. So it was always a problem, and I learned to very quickly to have a sort of standard line that I was learning Vietnamese, and I really would appreciate their speaking to me in Vietnamese because it would help me, and so that it would save face for them. And I recognized their wonderful ability in French, but I had to admit that they were far superior than I, and that I really needed to practice my Vietnamese. And that generally worked. Sometimes it didn't. They just carried right on because of this belief that education equals French, and that if you're educated, this is you're French, and this is how you communicate, and this is how you deal with all things educational. But usually it did. So I taught not only in the high school or the lycée, but I taught more than I could have spent all waking hours and then some teaching, because there were various groups in the hospital, for example, other community groups that simply came with representation wanting to learn English. They really did want to learn English, adults in the community who were in jobs.
Were any of these folks who were asking for your services part of the, you're going to have to help me with my pronunciation, the Wahao sect?
The Wahao.
Wahao.
They might have been. It was difficult for me to discern who was who. I dealt with so many people, and it is amazing. I know, for example, that I must have had people who were very sympathetic to, if not involved in, the Viet Cong. And I had people who were very suspicious.
Of me,
who wondered what an individual would be doing living right in the center of this provincial town. The only European type there, not military.
Well, it is curious.
Very curious.
Yeah, it is. You think about it, it is a very curious thing. What the hell is he doing here?
Yes, there were suspicions shared later confidentially by colleagues with whom I worked and got to know very well, including the physics teachers who lived with me. He was, and as I think of it, he was very brave as well to live with me because there were people who wondered who I was, very suspicious. There was the suspicion, for example, that I might have been with the CIA. That came up in more than once. That
how
I was really.
How would that come up?
I don't know. Well, it would come up confidentially through friends who would just frankly ask me, are you really associated? Are you really a volunteer? Are you not associated with some other? Clandestine organization. And I would have to say, no, I really am not. I'm just not. That was difficult for a lot of Vietnamese to believe, and particularly Vietnamese of, I had, for example, some very well-off Vietnamese who wanted to learn English and who through various ways wanted tutorials, and because they were of a very superior class and had lots of money, they thought they could do this and by paying and by offering all kinds of amenities. And of course, I wasn't in a position to do that. But it was interesting to meet some, and the parents of some of my students, who actually thought, you know, that just simply couldn't conceive of anyone doing this as a volunteer for nothing. It was very, it was just beyond capacity to believe. And they, you know, they understood the church very often in doing this, but even the church they found to be rather grasping, I think, in some instances, and sort of corrupt. They were wanting something, too.
Well, even so, one of the Ngo brothers was a bishop.
Oh, exactly. So there wasn't all that much confidence, even if you had said, well, I'm a priest sworn to poverty.
And they say, ha, 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 yeah.
Yeah, right. They knew there were other motives. So that was, one just had a hard time dealing with that. And in the end, I think it just had to be a matter of developing trust as best one could, working very hard, and you know, living a clean kind of life to be a to dispel this kind of idea that you're there for some ulterior reason. And that was a difficulty, and it was always there. However, I must say that many students of my students, I think, would never have thought that, and were very trusting, wanting very much to learn. A lot of students, though, were again very skeptical. I used to, for example, I'd always wished that I'd saved it. It was rather frightening at the time. I got a note once that was in three different languages: French, Chinese, and Vietnamese and English.
So you couldn't mistake it.
Yes, and
That their ability would come through in one of them anyway.
And these were from just avowed Viet Cong. They
really
said, it was a very cryptic message, to which was something to the effect of, you know, you need to watch out. You better be careful. You know, just this sort of cryptic message that was written, and was in my little box at the school. And of course, I told the principal about it, and he—I never knew who did it, but you were aware through that and other little subtle means that
people were around.
Oh yes, and that they weren't all enamored of of me or of my mission.
Even if they believed you were doing this for free, they still didn't care.
No, that's right. So there was that element. But I don't want to exaggerate it, because I think that one did always know in the back of one's mind, one had to relegate these things to the back of your mind, because you would just have gone nuts thinking that there was Viet Cong behind every bush and every corner. You'd never gone anywhere, done anything for that sort of fear. And I don't want to exaggerate that, but one knew that that was around, even though it was in early days. I was able to, in these early days, by the way, to ride on the train all the way to Hue. It was a horrifying experience. We had to lie down on the floor for gunfire. But in those early days, very early days, it soon ended, the train line was open symbolically to unite, that the country was united, that it was together. And I very foolishly, there's so many things that I did looking back on it, thinking, oh, Lord, why did I do this? But I was did, you know, everything, and I think a lot of volunteers did. Not without some caution, but things that were very dangerous. And military men tend to think I and others of us, and I guess we're just absolutely out of our heads, that we were there in the first place, and in the second place, that we would be consorting with Vietnamese, who were all of whom were potential enemies for some people.
They were obsessing.
Oh, yes, quite. And I remember, of course, having some associations with the military, but being very careful about it, because, again, this would exacerbate the, you know, the view that there was somehow a linkage and that there were dark and ulterior motives. When in fact I was a teacher, I was there to try to get to know people, to help them. And one of the reasons, by the way, that I was at Long Xuyên was because the idea, and it was an awfully good one, that if you're going to be teaching teachers, and which was what I was meant to be doing, ultimately, at the Faculty of Pedagogy, if you're going to be doing that, you need to know where these teachers are going. And so therefore you need to have experience as a teacher at a lycée level, so that you know when you're teaching these folks who are going out into these lycées, you'll know exactly what kind of situation, kind of classroom conditions, kinds of conditions about equipment.
What they don't do in colleges of education.
That's
here.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That you go out into the situation. That was a brilliant...
And actually get to know what you're talking about.
A brilliant idea.
Because yes.
I would have been just positively unbearable, I think, without this realism and the experience. My experience was cut really rather short because of these frequent coups. It was deemed dangerous for me to be there because, again, I was relatively isolated. The military was there. I had very little to do with them. I hitched rides sometimes to Saigon. But it was cut rather short than I had anticipated. Other things happened. So that I moved very quickly into administration after this.
Really?
Yes, and not through any design of mine, but because of various personnel shifts, and also of lots of political shifts. We had to be very flexible. We had to be able to move wherever we could and whenever we had to any kind of situation. But this was wonderful because it enabled me to go virtually throughout the country to visit teachers.
Yeah, before you get into that, I'd like to backtrack just a little bit.
Good.
Because and our tape is going to run out. I'm going to have to put in a fresh one here.
Okay.
So I'll just pose the things and you can
right.
think about
okay,
stuff.
Okay, good.
First, you were describing, the tape is just now gone. So, let's see. So particularly, you know, around the time of Diem's fall, when you're just there new, because as I understood it, that would have led to a real great change in...